Hi there, I'm Zoe Clark and welcome back to our next episode in the Without Borders podcast series. Today we're joined by the fantastic Alex Wood, whose publication The Memo was acquired by Forbes earlier this year. Alex now leads Forbes Europe Operations as their Europe editor.
Hi, and I'm Brendan Craigie, and on this episode, Alex is going to share some more background on Forbes' expansion plans. He's going to tell us why he thinks budding journalists should spend more time researching and listening and less time broadcasting on social media. And he's also going to tell us about how he overcame his smartphone addiction.
So tell us a bit, first of all, I guess, about where it all began for you. How did you get into this world of journalism at the beginning?
So I have quite an unusual story when it comes to journalism. I actually started my career in Japan. So I was out there doing a year of university there. I learnt Japanese at school as well. I went to this very unusual school in the middle of nowhere in the Cotswolds that decided to do Japanese, Chinese, Russian, every
Amazing.
European language going. And so I thought that was normal until I got to my undergrad uni and realised that other people didn't have this experience of international exchange students in the school all the time. But when I arrived in Japan, I had a tutor at the university, and he actually changed my life, a man called Professor Hada, because he said, what kind of internship do you want to do and work experience? And I sort of looked at him and said, well, I guess, you know, I do Japanese and business. A bank. I think that seems like a good start in life
start,
to
yeah.
make the mother happy. And actually, he sort of looked at me steely-eyed straight through into my face, and like with the glare of a samurai, it really was. And he just knew that that wasn't me, and asked me what I really wanted to do, and it was to become a reporter. And fast forward a few months, and he got me, I believe, one of the first foreign internships at a Japanese newspaper. I started out at a newspaper called the Sankei Shimbun, and ended up writing in Japanese before even writing in English. Still to this day in Japan, people call me long legs in the media, because if you can imagine, I was that much taller than every single person in every newsroom and every press conference as well. And that's really how I started off in journalism.
That's an incredible
that's
story.
Quite phenomenal, isn't it? From somebody who also, funnily enough, studied Japanese at university,
oh, really?
Would you believe? That's quite phenomenal that you can write and do journalism in Japanese. Incredible.
I'm guessing that forced you to be especially disciplined with your language, and that when you know, maybe provide sort of like an extra level of rigor when you're writing in a foreign language.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie, it was challenging, as I'm sure you'll appreciate, especially
yes.
you know, written Japanese is very different to
yes.
spoken Japanese as well. I was very lucky and very blessed that I think a lot of my colleagues at the newspaper recognised how hard this was, and that, of course, I had a lot of coaching and sub-editing as well. But I think I've always been surrounded by languages, and I was really lucky. Even when I was at school, I used to spend my summers, and it's bonkers when you think about it, when I tell people, I used to go to Japan by myself at 15.
Yeah.
I used to get on a plane. And the host families that I'd made friends with from the school exchange invited me back. And my mother thought this was great. You know, I can go off for a summer, experience life. And so I've always been really adventurous and very open to languages and other cultures.
Yeah.
So I started to pick it up.
Mm. Do you think that kind of experience, I know certainly for me in some traveling and doing that kind of year abroad type thing, or putting yourself in these very, very foreign worlds, gives you a certain kind of no fear attitude? In general, I think obviously from what we can see from your career and the different things you've done, you know, some really incredible sort of building blocks and achievements. Do you think that no fear attitude is something that you can relate to and has helped you throughout your life?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also about being relatable and understanding where other people are coming from. And I'm guessing you've been to Japan many times as well. And I remember vividly experiences like walking the dog in the summer when I was 15, and people would actually slam the brakes on their car in utter shock, because I was in the middle of nowhere. I was near Mount Fuji in the countryside. My host family were peach farmers. So, you know, the shock of seeing this foreign kid just walking around with a dog and actually just striking up a conversation and explaining it and making friends. And I think people often underestimate that about Japan in particular, that it's a very developed country, but they're really not used to foreign people outside of the big city. So I guess, yes, it kind of gave me a kick to be more open-minded and not be afraid to try and strike a conversation.
And so if you were chatting to sort of people that were considering a career in journalism, you were giving them the same steely eye that your mentor did to you, What do you think that people need in order to you know, what's in terms of their character and personality, what do they need to be a successful journalist? And do you have any sort of advice as well that, you know, about things not to do, etc.?
So this is something I think I have a lot of experience with. I've had a really interesting career where when I came back from Japan, ended up in City University's journalism school, they put me in the international course, which was purely because I'd never written in English. And as far as they were concerned, I was an international student. Turned out to be an absolute blessing. Again, got to meet lots of people from around the world. But years later, they asked me to come back, and I'm still a visiting lecturer at City. It's now my eighth year. I can tell you, it makes me feel really old because they're the same age every single year and you're 1 year older. And, you know, I used to be the young, cool lecturer, and now I think I've sort of graduated out of that part of my life.
I think you can still qualify as young and cool.
I hope so. I hope so.
Certainly in this room anyway.
But through doing that, I think obviously I get asked a lot by my students about advice and careers. And one thing I really wanted to share with you is that I think, if I was to look back at my own experience and other people who've broken into the industry, I think sometimes we put too much of an emphasis on social media and the digital side of our life. And that might sound quite counter to what seems to be quite a tech-themed podcast that you're working through, but it's something that I've really noticed.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the sort of, it's almost like the more you sort of huff and puff and sort of push your opinion, then somehow that's where you should put all your effort rather than potentially spending more time on the development of ideas. That's what you mean?
To give you a tangible example, we have amazing guest lecturers at City University. We'll have, you know, the head of the BBC is a regular guest, for example. And we've had instance in the past where students have spent the entire lecture furiously tweeting with their head down at their phone. And actually it's, you know, not necessarily in that example, but we've had speakers actually complain to us saying, you know, why aren't these students actually engaging with us, listening to what I'm saying? But then at the end of it, I also think when I was at journalism school, and I remember Hugh Pym was there, and the second he stopped speaking, I was ready on the edge of my seat to dart up there and, you know, and grab my internship, grab that opportunity. And I think sometimes in this digital world, we're forgetting that actually that face-to-face moment, that communication is so very important.
Yeah.
So how does that, that kind of, you know, opinion and thoughts that you have around social media and use in journalism relate also to the idea of 24-hour news today and also online media and online news, which obviously is totally your world? How does that fit together?
I think it's something I've really been thinking about with the transition from having my own business to Forbes as well. I think Forbes is in a really unique position, having over 70 million unique readers every single month. But as I'm sure we'll delve into in more depth, we have the contributor model as well. But in an increasingly competitive news landscape, I've come to the realization, it was the same with the memo as well, that there is little point in playing in this game of being the fastest, being the most reactive. And all it ends up with everyone just towing the same line, everyone following the news wires. And so I believe actually it's about smart takes. And that's very much Forbes' view as well, that it's okay sometimes if we have a real careful piece of analysis that's even a day later than when it broke. But if we've got the one that actually moves a market, we've got the one that people really care about, I think that's more important than that. Rebuilding that level of trust, I think, with readers is really important. I hope that we see it in the rest of the media as well.
And do you think, how does that all sort of relate to the discussion around fake news? Do you think part of the issue is that we've just got sort of addicted to news, and you know, is that part of the problem, do you think?
Yeah, I think there's some fundamental issues with both the fake news issue and also the business model around news as well. And it's something that in some ways I'm very uniquely placed to comment on because I've had my own news business as well, and I've seen both sides of it. And I think there has to be a bigger conversation. And I think if there's anything good to have come out of, let's say, the Facebook scandal or other issues that have been out there, is that consumer awareness has now increased. And I think people on the street are actually saying, you know what, am I getting the right news? Or is the thing that's at the top of Google News, is that the most trustworthy source? So in general, in technology, I believe that we often think of everything as being, you know, hockey stick growth curves or just neat lines that go up. But actually, in reality, innovation kind of goes up very sharply and then comes back a bit. And that's very healthy, in my opinion. I think we need to have a little bit of a return backwards and then consider and then continue on.
Yeah, makes sense. So tell us a little bit then about how life is at the moment. How's it all going? What's your daily kind of routine, but what's a day in the life of Alex Wood like?
Life is good. I honestly wake up in the mornings and I still pinch myself thinking this is just an incredible place that I'm at. I even said to my journalism professors a couple of months ago that taught me, I didn't expect sort of 10 years after going to journalism school to become the European editor of Forbes. It is honestly beyond my wildest dreams. So I still feel like it's fresh, even though it's 6 months. But a normal day for me, I start the morning with reviewing the news, usually a mixture of radio, TV, and good old-fashioned newspaper, but on my iPad. I think it's really important in my role to have a good understanding and a broad view of what's happening in the world. And again, I've really come to appreciate newspapers in the last couple of years that actually that curated, editorialized view of what is in the world, rather than necessarily sort of going on the anxiety bandwagon that is Twitter and, you know, just the never-ending stream of things without any actual curation. I think actually newspapers are good.
Yeah.
I guess they give you that broad perspective, don't they, rather than just a narrow viewpoint of things that the people you follow might identify with.
Yeah, exactly. And I know I'm sort of sounding like I'm reinventing the wheel because newspapers have been around for years and I've only just really got into them in the last five, but I've also really come to appreciate great comment writers recently as well, and columnists, and realizing how important, particularly the Times, I think, has excellent experts in many spaces. And so I find that's really useful. And I interpret that about what's happening in the news and what's going to change in the news in the future as well.
Yeah.
So how have things changed? Obviously, going from the memo to Forbes, how has it changed things for you? What kind of are you feeling in any way? You know, you have to toe a certain line now being part of a bigger group. How does it work?
So I think before the acquisition happened, obviously I had many advisors and mentors with the business, and I had to really do a lot of soul searching to ask myself if the time was right and if this is going to be the right fit as well. And I realized very early on when I first met with people from Forbes that it was going to be a great fit. And the reason why is because so many of the senior management within Forbes are actually former entrepreneurs themselves. My direct boss, Randall Lane, has been a media entrepreneur for many years, as is our CEO, Mike Federley, as well. And I'm sure you guys will know this from the entrepreneurs you work with in your agency as well, that you just know there's a certain type when you're dealing with entrepreneurs. And we just got on right away. And without naming names, the first person I met, we were meant to meet for dinner. And I think two bottles of wine later, like 4 hours later, you know, we were still having an amazing chat. And I think if you can sit across a table from someone and you get on that well, it's a fabulous sign. And so transition-wise, obviously, it is a very different world. I'm working with, so many more people, hundreds of people across continents now. But I think the entrepreneurial spirit and also the kind of family business spirit that Forbes was founded on 102 years ago is still very much there. Steve Forbes is still around in the office. Moira Forbes is there as well. You see them. And I think it's a very unique media company. You know, we're not part of a much larger stable of publications either.
No, I think it's always, I think that whole bit working with entrepreneurial types is they're just very single-minded and have a vision, and that's very intoxicating, isn't it? It sort of just rubs off on other people, which obviously, you know, because you created, you know, your own business beforehand. What was the inspiration for you creating the memo previously?
So the inspiration for the memo, if we go back one step, so after going to City and ended up at the BBC World Service as well, I worked at Bloomberg TV as a producer, and this was, as I'm sure you'll both remember fondly, back in the kind of crazy Silicon Roundabout Tech City days. I think you were based very nearby.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I was covering, you know, big markets, it's Bloomberg stories, but then I was the really irritating, precocious young junior producer who was jumping up and down going, guys, we're in Finsbury Circus or Finsbury Square in the centre of the financial district. But over there, literally on our doorstep, is something really exciting.
Yeah.
And I eventually got my way a couple of times and they let me do a couple of TV packages. I'll never forget, actually, the founder of Monzo, when he was at his last startup. I was one of the first TV crews to go and interview him. He was literally across Finsbury Square. Did the TV package. It was great. It was a little bit rough around the edges. It's a startup. I brought it back, and I remember I got a severe telling off by my executive producer because they were all wearing T-shirts. And why are they not wearing suits? They should be wearing suits on Bloomberg. Yeah. And it was one of those kind of funny defining moments. Yeah. I was like, this guy's going to be big. And now look at him now.
You know, now you are showing your age.
Yes, I really am. But while that was happening, I remember there was a publishing house based in Old Street that said they wanted to launch a magazine covering Tech City, as it was known then. And a couple of coffees later and conversations, I somehow ended up taking the job as the launch editor for that. And I think it was a really interesting entry into entrepreneurial journalism for me personally, because I took the job and I got to the office on the first day, and I had this kind of image of this buzzing newsroom and, you know, a team and things going on. It's literally no one. They had a domain. There was a sort of a sort of business plan. But you know what? That's a great challenge. And so I got given a huge amount of freedom to actually build it and start to build a team. We had great commercial people on the side as well who came in and grew that side of the business. And so over the course of 2.5-3 years, we built it to the market leader within that space. But also, as you mentioned, infectious entrepreneurial types. Being based in Old Street, you're just surrounded by them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got to meet them, I got to cover them. I still consider many of them as my close friends as well. And so there came a point where I thought, I have to have a crack at this, really.
Yeah.
And the whole time while this was happening, I also noticed, and this was really the inspiration for the memo, that lots of my friends who worked in the city or worked in Soho kept saying to me, like, it looks really cool what you're doing, it looks very interesting. I haven't got a clue what you're talking about. This, you keep saying this word disruption, you keep talking about pivoting and all these bizarre words,
right.
And you keep putting something with tech, you know, and I know you're a fintech specialist, but back then maybe you wouldn't know what that was.
Absolutely.
And the real inspiration behind the memo was, what if there could be a magazine that sat in the middle and act as the friendly bridge between the big business corporate world and everyday life and the cutting edge of technology? And that's why it had a intentionally not tech name.
Yes, great. So sort of like demystifying and making it more accessible.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any particularly cringeworthy moments along the way, or any sort of mistakes you can draw on that you've necessarily maybe learned from or what have you?
Oh gosh, what can I think of? I might have a moment to think about this. From the memo journey more specifically, or just in general?
In general, it sounds like you've definitely thrown yourself into some situations in life. Sounds like it's all gone brilliantly, but I'm sure.
No, there's been... I think...
Maybe someone will come to you while we're talking.
what do I...
Don't worry.
I can well, have some water. Is it just me or is it really hot?
I did a yoga
class earlier, so I don't know if I'm just hot from that.
There's been a lot of hot air chatting today.
Yes.
It's not you, it's all us, don't worry.
I think I wouldn't say it's necessarily a direct mistake, but I think something that I've learned along the way is about focus.
Yeah.
And I think it's you'll hear that from many entrepreneurs,
I'm sure,
in your work. But again, in my work in journalism, I think it's so easy to get really excited by Meerkat, Periscope, you know, all the latest shiny new thing. And I think it applies just as much to communications as well. And actually, throughout my career and I think throughout my teaching as well, I really try and champion craft and actually going back. And if I'd spent a little less time worrying about live streaming video and a little bit more time on actually being a better writer in terms of developing interviewing skills, things like that, I think it's so easy to be overlooked. And so that's maybe one regret I have.
No, that's a fair point. I think we as a business, sort of obviously starting up any new business, that's a bit of a key thing we keep thinking about, isn't it? How to focus on the real priorities and what's really important.
Yeah, for sure.
Are you a year in now?
So yeah, we're just coming up to be a year in October.
Yes.
Yeah, so no, it's going really well. We've sort of surpassed all of our expectations and we've got sort of a team now across Europe and got a couple more people joining in the next few weeks. So no, it's super exciting. I mean, it's just like... I came from a large business, relatively large, 250 people around the world. And then I think just the opportunity to define yourself against what exists and to start with like a blank sheet of paper, have lots of conversations and sort of really pinpoint how you're going to be different and then to go after it is very exciting. But when you start that journey, you know, you can have this vision, but you don't quite know whether people are going to buy into it. So you know, it's satisfying and also reassuring that 1 year in that a lot of people have bought into it, both in terms of employees and clients. So yeah, no, it's very, very motivating, very motivating.
I think like the self-doubt is probably one of the most powerful things
totally.
When you're an entrepreneur.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, you sort of think, I always harbored a desire to start my own business, you know? And so I was part of a team that grew a very successful company from the start, but, you know, I was never the founder as such. And throughout that sort of 17-year journey with one company, which grew from nothing to like 250 people around the world, I always had this thing about wanting to do my own thing, but just it was always, you always felt that, but what if it doesn't work? You know, like what if it's not successful? And despite having probably pretty good credentials for something to be successful, you always have that doubt.
Yeah.
And I think that there are so many people out there that sort of question their ability to make something happen. I think if there was anything you could do to sort of give people more confidence, then it would be, the world would probably be a better place.
Yeah, and I think coming back to what I was saying about digital and over-reliance on it, it shame to say, it took me about 18 months to realize, rather than obsessively Googling things and trying to find the, you know, obscure answers to very niche entrepreneurial problems, actually ringing another founder and,
yes.
you know, actually picking
yeah.
up the phone or going for a coffee. And I'm sure you both have this, that actually when you step out of the office and just...
talk to people.
Yeah. Unload
oh,
it all.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, it's that for us, it was that process of having some ideas and really questioning them with other people and sort of that honing your idea, but through a process of discussion and like getting feedback from people, that was really helped sharpen up what we were going to be and what we were different, and then going out there and testing it. Good question for you. I think obviously you've been closely involved with the technology sector for a long time. It's probably over that time had good press and bad press, and it sort of feels like it's maybe going through a bit of a challenging time at the moment, you know, with technology associated with lots of problems. What's your perspective on that?
I think it's like I was saying earlier about cycles. I think we're in a kind of a cycle where we're pulling back a bit, but it's actually a very healthy thing.
Yeah.
I think something that I've really noticed, particularly covering bubbling startup hotspots, if you like, is actually the number of times that people are trying to solve problems that are respectfully first world problems.
Yeah.
You know, the problems that really don't need to be solved, like finding a restaurant to meet your friends that's near the train station for both of you. You know, things that don't really matter. And I think there's been a really interesting movement, especially in the last year or two, around social impact startups. And it's not to say that the capitalistic money-making side of that's not important as well, but I think it's really interesting that people are starting to think about purpose and mission-driven businesses. And so that's something I've really enjoyed about Forbes, actually, the 30 Under 30 initiative they have, which is just bonkers. We just had our first summit in Amsterdam just 2 weeks ago. I'm still recovering from it. 600 people in the city going absolutely nuts. But when you meet people like that, the future leaders of tomorrow, it's amazing how so many of them are actually, core to them is about their mission and their purpose,
right.
And how they're actually going to be a good thing for society,
yeah.
as well as make money. And I think that's really interesting.
That is really interesting, yeah. Someone I was at that event you were yes. just talking about. Yeah, so that's really exciting.
Yeah, it's really encouraging, isn't it?
Happy
to think they're like that. So tell us a bit more about Forbes and the plans, because it's surprising really that Forbes has only just come across the pond after over 100 years in journalism, right? So
yes.
What can we expect?
Expect a huge expansion of everything that we're doing. So prior to the Memo acquisition, we had two staff writers and about 180 contributors across the continent. On the contributor front, we are doubling down. We are looking towards 500 contributors across the continent. That's a huge part of the work I'm doing. And for anyone that's not familiar with the contributor model, what it essentially means is that Forbes works with a network of experts. They're not always journalists. Some of them are journalists. Some of them can be academics. Some of them are analysts in financial houses. And we welcome them to share their expert view on what's going on in the world on Forbes. And what it does is it gives us this humongous reach. We have over 2,000 contributors on the platform right now. And as an editor, it's really interesting, actually, because in some ways it means I have to let go control. I don't have oversight of every single piece that goes out there. But yet at the same time, we have a really good quality system where actually we make sure that we vet people, we understand who they are, we make sure they're not conflicted. And we kind of actually say, and I say this to a lot of contributors, putting my hands up, I don't know everything. I cannot be an expert in every single space. And you know, we have one guy that writes about the Russian gas market, and he's one of the world's leading authorities on that. And he does very well. And Forbes is a platform for him to be able to share it. So one key part of it is really on that contributor model.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah. And so we live in this world where there's just like so much content. And you talked a little bit about, you know, about the what type of journalism you value. Do you think in this world where everyone wants to publish or self-publish or, you know, publish through other things, do you think that the best content and the best journalism does rise to the top? Does it get through or not?
I think I don't think we're living in a perfect world. And I think even today, we're not always getting the best journalism rising to the top. I do believe, at least based on my own personal viewing habits and also other people that I speak to, that people are starting to reevaluate the brand that's associated with it. And Forbes is not unique in having a contributor model. There are other publications that do that. And I think people are starting to look. I mean, the FT is somewhere that I hugely admire. And I think particularly with what's happened economically around the world and politically, the FT has really shown that you need a trusted brand in that space and you need real experts. And so there is a certain realignment that I'm seeing. And I think it's a positive thing. And like I said about our contributors, they are very, very niche experts in their space. They're the people who are speaking at the key conferences in those spaces and very well regarded. And I think our readers start to build a relationship personally with those contributors.
Yeah.
And we very much incentivize them to create a loyal audience, to make sure that people keep coming back for them as well. And I think it's a really unique model in journalism.
Yeah. And I guess you've obviously, in your past roles and present, you come across a lot of really interesting people, these entrepreneurial types. Is there anything, any advice you would give to them if they're trying to find their voice? Because I think often some very smart, clever people are just like a little bit nervous of sticking their neck out there. Do you have any sort of advice to them in terms of how they might become a contributor and how do they become a successful contributor? What does it take?
I think the first and foremost, it's about having a point of view. And also not being self-promotional. So the one thing that we really do watch carefully is about being self-promotional. Yeah. But the really smart contributors are the ones that are plugged into the industry that they work in. They understand what's going on. Sometimes they're going to take a contrarian view. Sometimes they're going to do a takedown. They're going to have a strong opinion. But that's what really works. A strong, considered opinion backed up by a lot of industry expertise can really work for a contributor.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's interesting about the point of view thing, because I think that's something
we
advise our clients very strongly.
Yeah. I mean, I speak to many people in PR and communication. I imagine that is a challenge when you're speaking to people, because people don't want to put their neck out on the line and they don't want to upset the apple cart.
You have to encourage people sometimes, don't you?
But, you know, like, I wonder if you can sort of elaborate on that in terms of this point about a point of view.
Mm.
What sort of things, like, could you maybe elaborate on that in terms of what does that mean exactly?
I think if we zoom out from just the contributor model and just talk about news in general, what I say to a lot of founders who maybe aren't working with an agency yet or just doing it by themselves is that respectfully, and I know this because I've been in that position myself, you raising some money, not that interesting. You launching a new product, not that interesting. It's actually, what view do you have on what's happening right in front of you? What interesting internal story do you have? I mean, some of the, just from my memory, some of the most interesting people I've spoken to in recent years was a famous female founder who said, do you know what the problem with women in tech is? Women in tech. And, you know, and I won't elaborate any further, but yeah. It was, what a fantastic way to get my attention.
Yes.
And to, and she had a strong point of view. And
yeah.
And I think she wasn't afraid to say it. And she may have you know, lost some friends in that, but I think she actually did put a considered viewpoint across there. And so I think it's so easy when you're stuck in your business in the thick of it to look at each milestone, because, and I know I've been there as well, you want your investors to see, tick, you've got that press coverage, it's been noted in the public record. But actually, people that have said to me, I mean, in the past, people who've said that certain events in the tech space are awful and I wouldn't be, want to be seen dead there, they're a waste of money, they screw over startups, that's a great story.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
things
yeah.
like that where, you know, talk about what's really happening.
Yeah.
I've had founders that, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, this is definitely an issue and a challenge we face with clients sometimes. In giving them the, you know, empowering them to feel like they should be able to put their opinions out there. But equally, something else we often find challenging is that they don't feel necessarily qualified to speak about particular things. Where would you say the line is there? Like how way out or how far out should people go, or how near should they stick to their
I think
comfort zone?
Nobody wants to you know, be talking for the sake of talking.
Sure.
and not come from a position of knowledge. But I think also journalists today really value personal stories and personal experiences. And just because your personal experience isn't, or you don't run the biggest company in the world, or you don't have the largest wealth of experience over many years, doesn't mean that it's not at all valid. And, you know, I remember, to give another example of a founder I spoke to whose really tiny company absolutely fell apart because essentially she hadn't taken control of the domains and all the technology for her startup, and she had a falling out with her contracted developer who wanted equity, et cetera, et cetera. You know, these kind of things happen all the time in early stage businesses. But actually, yes, that's a tiny, tiny story. And in a Bloomberg sense, that's not going to move a market. But I think it's a really interesting example how, you know, not getting your house in order early on in the business and not, you know, understanding ownership. And I think that's something that I would love other founders out there to hear about. And so it's little things like that that I think are really, really valuable.
Okay. So I think, we obviously, PR is a pretty 24-hour type of thing in terms of, you know, the type of how news can develop, and so always needing to be switched on, which I'm guessing is exactly the same for you in the world of media. How do you juggle your work responsibilities and the need to be sort of connected to everything that's going on with like staying sane and human and disconnecting? How do you manage that?
I'm hopefully doing a good job of staying sane and human so far this year. I think it's something that I've really explored a lot myself in my own work in the last couple of years. Much to the amusement of many people around, I have a BlackBerry. Yes, I have one of the new BlackBerries that have Androids. It's not quite as embarrassing as having a traditional BlackBerry. But Forbes very kindly agreed for me to do that when I joined. And it's a very conscious decision. So I have an iPhone for outside of work and a BlackBerry for work stuff. And one of the reasons why I did that is because they are completely different form factors. And so I used to write a lot about smartphone addiction and technology overwhelmness and things like that. And one academic I spoke to a couple of years ago, and it's really stuck with me, told me about how if you think about 10, 15 years ago, when we would be at work, we'd be at a desktop computer, it'd be very much one posture. You go home and you'd watch television, and perhaps you may be horizontal, it's up to you. But those postures are very different. And there's been a link that they found in academic study between relaxation and working and how your body is being held. And if you now fast forward to how you are today, most of us work on a laptop. We go home, watch Netflix on a laptop, and we use our smartphones during the day and at night. And what he told me was that your brain isn't actually properly slowing down, even though you are watching a program on Netflix and maybe you have notifications as well. And so I've been experimenting with this for the last 6 months. My BlackBerry, I'll show you afterwards, is about three times the size of this tiny little iPhone with an obnoxious keyboard.
Yeah.
But I've done it intentionally to have a completely tactile feel.
Yeah.
And I put it in a different room when I'm at home as well.
Yeah.
I militantly do not bring it in my bedroom. And I go to the work phone and I sort of use it as a way of trying to split those things apart. I mean, all of us need to be switched on all the time, but I think for me it's about having very clear boundaries of, you know, when I'm eating a meal, my work phone's not there, things like that. And I find that's hugely beneficial for me.
No, I agree. I think I think having those separations is so important. Like, I mean, if I'm out at the weekend, you know, with my kids and going for a walk or something for an hour or so, I'll deliberately not take my phone with me because I don't need it. You know, why, you know, so actually just having that, those times when you're completely disconnected, you're not tempted to take a photo and share it on Instagram or whatever. I just think it's so healthy just to have those moments of pure disconnection and actually spend time focused on the things and the people that you love, you know, not in a sort of a filtered or not sharing them with your phone, but actually, you know, giving yourself to them.
Surely it's not also just about switching off, but it's at those times where you actually get the inspiration to carry on and maybe new ideas.
And
come as well,
I think that's a really important point, is I think that process of disconnecting and having completely different experiences is what allows you, well, to mentally and physically recharge, but also I think to give inspiration to be creative. Because I think if you're constantly operating in this sort of same world, same environment, you're not mentally recharging, you know, with different perspectives that's going to allow you to be creative.
And it's so funny, I know you've seen a piece that I wrote about 18 months ago about smartphone addiction, where I came out as a smartphone addict and talked about how I cured myself, which oddly enough became a TV program later on as well. It's one of the stranger things that's happened in my career. And since doing that, and I don't want to sound arrogant or pretentious, I've become so aware of other people. And often I'll just be sat there with my friends and I'll literally go, 1, 2, 3, 4, like you are all staring at your phones. And it's once you've gone through that process of kind of re-evaluating and realigning what you do with your devices, you just realise that everyone's walking around like zombies. It's like you're in another world. And I do think again, it's a really positive thing. I know that the new version of iOS for Apple, which I think is coming out today, is going to automatically track people's Instagram and other usage and sort of nag you and point out that you're addicted. And I think we really are on the wave of something that's changing.
I don't know who it is, but there was some sociologist that talked about the expression of being alone together. You know, so when you're with this group of people and you're all on your phone, you're sort of alone but together, you know, because you're not fully engaged in that. And I guess in some ways it comes back to your point earlier about journalism and needing to listen and observe. And if you're not,
Well, I'm married to a lawyer, so it's a similar kind of career path of constant emails and things like that.
Do they keep you in check?
He's worse than me, actually,
right.
And he'll hate me for saying this on your podcast, but I am constantly nagging. But I think it's that culture and that expectation. I think working in the law, you're expected, working with clients, to be reachable. And I think it's very difficult because you just can't disconnect.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Absolutely. So there's a question we want to put to you about your desert island desk, which is a new concept we're coming up with relating to the Without Borders theme of the podcast. So something we're really passionate about at Taito is not being constrained by any particular place. We can work anywhere. We have what we call a location agnostic model. So I guess the question for you is, you know, if you could work anywhere, if you could work to any particular process, what kind of setup, what kind of process, where in the world might that be?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I think thinking back to my memo days where I had a huge amount of freedom to to create these things. I feel really passionate about having absolutely no physical files or storage on a machine. I built that business from the ground up. Everything was in the cloud, and people got severe tellings off if they saved documents onto machines. And what that actually meant was, in the 6 or 7 co-working spaces we were in 3 years, every fire alarm that happened or anything that went wrong with the office, it never ever impacted the business. I remember fondly the second office we were in London Bridge. Someone drove a transit van into the broadband switchy thing, the green things you have on the street, mm-hmm. took out the internet for the office for a week. My business is fine.
We're fine.
You know, and I'm sure it's the same for you guys having this remote model as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's incredibly liberating. So that would definitely be something as part of that. But at the same time, And I've had this since I've joined Forbes as well, because we've been thinking a lot about how we lay out the office. Mm-hmm. And I have quite a unique challenge, actually, in that I've inherited some staff. My staff from the memo have come across. There's also a great commercial team that have been based in London for a long time as well. And so we're kind of fusing together lots of people at once. And I'm a bit of a design nerd, and I've been really thinking about how we can create collaboration spaces, for want of a better expression,
yeah.
You know, how we can make sure that we can be coming together. And in terms of tools as well, I think to kind of name drop one tool that I really like, and I've recently reintroduced to Forbes, is 15.5. I don't know if you guys have come across 15.5. So if I tell you it's a sort of employee reporting tool, many people will switch off, but it's actually brilliant. It's called 15.5 because it's meant to take no more than 15 minutes for each person on a Monday or a Friday or whenever you like to fill in a basic form of what's going on. But it uses a lot of behavioral psychology and delight and surprises. The form changes every single week. It asks really simple things like, how do you feel today? And it's a sort of sad to happy. And then it also asks people to talk about obviously what's going on in their week. But it asks you some really silly things like, We put one in today, actually. How likely do you think the plants in the office will last until Christmas? You know, the little things like that. To who would you love to go for a coffee with in the company that you haven't yet? And it constantly rotates and kind of just encourages communication and encourages sharing. But one thing I learned from having it at the memo was working with younger staff members. I find a lot of people are not always confident about sharing their feelings or about, at least verbally, putting it out there in a company. And I found a lot of people who are more introverted absolutely loved this, because when you put your information in this form, it then forms part of your one-to-one meetings and everything gets discussed face-to-face, but at least you can share something that's, you know, maybe something's happening at home, or, you know, there's something that's impacting your work. And I'm a big advocate of that.
Yeah. Is there a certain type of person who tend, you know, I'm thinking introverts, extroverts in your world, I'm wondering, are journalists, do they tend to be more on the introvert side, or am I
think they can be a real mixture. I notice it with my students. I think, at least on the surface, people tend to think of journalists as quite extroverted, but if you actually watch them in newsrooms these days, they don't pick up the phone so much, and I'm sure you find they don't answer the phone so much as well. And I think it's interesting, a lot of journalists are so deeply nestled within their beat and their own world and their own projects, their stories, and not necessarily the bigger picture of an organization. And so I think that's one of the interesting challenges I have now of being an editor, is about trying to oversee what everyone is doing and how that fits together into the bigger editorial piece. But yeah, I think, would you agree with that you think introverted or extroverted?
This is a very sweeping statement, yes. And a probably a stupid generalization, but sort of assumption that possibly people in PR, I was thinking, might tend to be more of the extroverts, kind of you see where I'm going with that?
Yeah.
From our perspective, that journalists might be more on the introvert side.
I think so. I guess, you know, it lends itself to that sort of more researching, reflecting, listening.
Yes.
Whereas PR people tend to be quite loud, yeah.
Possibly. What do you make of the whole PR journalism interplay? What role do you think PRs play? Are you a fan?
I think PRs are absolutely critical and essential. I think there's been a lot of misunderstandings or misalignments, and I think particularly having had my own business, I can understand where people are coming from in a better way. my concern with PR, to do a big sweeping generalization, is that model of where I know, because people ask me to recommend PRs and I've seen, you know, proposals and things like that, where it's almost a tick box exercise of, we have contacted X number of journalists and then we have nagged them, and call sheets, things like that. And I think when that business model exists and it then is then put over to the journalist, it starts to just deteriorate relationships.
Yeah.
And I think of the best PRs who I consider friends as well and I've known for years, sometimes I don't hear from them for 6 months, but it's because I'll hear from you when you know it's the right thing. And I know we've all got a job to do, and sometimes you've got clients that have demands, but I think when you have that business model of, you know, it's just hitting as many things as possible, it starts to cause misunderstandings.
Yeah. We've got this whole philosophy of perfect partnership. So that means perfect partnership with our clients, but perfect partnership also with, you know, journalists and other sort of stakeholders, because, you know, we have a duty, we think we have a duty of care to, you know, manage those relationships with the same level of care and attention that we would with our client relationships, because ultimately they're mutually, you know, they're mutually important to each other. So I would totally agree with you on that.
Great. Well, thank you ever so much.
Thank you so much, Alex. It's been great having you on the show.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Without Borders. If you like what you've heard, why not subscribe? And if you want to find out more about Tyto and what we're up to, you can find us at tytopr.com. That's TYTOPR.com.